My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Bal Harbor Group, which is located in the northern tip of Miami Beach in the state of Florida. We are a large group. We have 13 members. I am the youngest chronologically aged member of the group. We meet in God's waiting room. And the average age of my group is deceased. Thursday night at our regular meeting, they gave me the authorization to extend to you their greetings and to wish you a successful conference. The vote of our group was 7-6. I want to tell you about my drinking. Don't miss any of this. This is a thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, and my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. I gather you may understand that there was a little drinking went on in the neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Difficult to believe, but true. If you looked at where I lived, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. We had a large Irish family, but the rigors of childbirth were too much, and my father died when he was 33. Started, I know that I sauntered into one of the local joints and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon. I don't really recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. That was a neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked, and I liked the way it smelled, and I liked the way it tastes, and I liked what it did for my head. And I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. I liked the fist fights and the Irish music. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. And I followed it around for the next 20 years. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all of the difficulties and troubles you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. When they were finished with me, because a school made a mistake, I think, in the admissions office, in a small college in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood, and I went off to college, and my drinking changed. I went up to this place, and there were no bars in that state. There were just restaurants. And these people sat around tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words to some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over. It was a rather safe bet, and things were very slow on the campus. So one day I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And I ended up on a minesweeper in San Francisco. I hate to be indelicate at such a distinguished gathering, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept 3 to a tier. Now, don't get ahead of me. This is not easy, what I'm doing here. The new man slept on top. And I came back from my first liberty in the city of San Francisco with all the beer in me I could buy. And I went to sleep, and I had an attack. And I met the fellow who slept below me that night. I imagine he thought he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. It just not had occurred to him that it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was undistinguished, and I returned back to the neighborhood a couple of years later, undecorated, unhonored, unloved. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was absent without leave from the New York City Police Department. He had invited a citizen off a five-story roof, and the citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. Billy came out west here, and he went into a more peaceful line of work. He went back in the Marine Corps. The government was giving veterans $20 a week, $20 a month for 52 weeks. $20 a week for 52 weeks. 52-20 club. And I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts that come from time to time. I recalled that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there, and I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into this place, and there they were, sitting around the table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing no songs, wearing no shoes. So I got another pair of shoes, and now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was moderately solvent, and therefore moderately drunk all the time. And one day I was staggering around the campus in my usual shape when I noticed a list of names on the bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on the list. And that was extremely good news. I thought I had another year to go. I sent for the widow, and she came north to witness this great event. That was a very tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elm. About 10 years later, I served as a trustee of that college, and they were still talking about my mother. It isn't so often in the state of Vermont where they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. When I came back to the neighborhood, the question was what to do, and my uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. Of course, that's what my father had been, and that's what my brother had been, and that's what all my uncles and my cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. But I told them I had my own plans, and I didn't want to be a cop, and I was going to go to law school, and I had received a scholarship to law school, and so that's what I did. I didn't know anything about lawyers or law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me, but I have to tell you, when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. They were deadly, and they all had on a blue suit and they wore eyeglasses. Takes a little while, doesn't it, sometimes? I looked around for a companion, someone to drink with, but nobody drank in that crowd. They were all students. They were all grinding it out. So I went on a wagon for law school. I didn't drink. And I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And the result of it all was I came out, I had done well, and I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. My superiors there determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer. And so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I was only in the courthouse a little while when I discovered that all the really bright guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a more civilized, a more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water and ice, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this evening, and to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they destroyed me. After about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located this lady, or she had located me. I don't know how that works. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife. I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Ms. O'Keefe is from a totally different background than mine. She was raised in a beautiful home with parents and servants and a dog and a fence. In a word, her family had a buck. And I drank a lot in those days, but I knew what was going on. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight. It was not a particularly good fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, Mrs. O'Keefe and I settled down and set up housekeeping, and she therefore began to produce children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion, and with a regularity that is known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after a couple of years of this, I received a phone call one day from the dean of the law school I had attended, and he invited me down, and I went down to see the dean. And he appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe at the Fordham University School of Law. And I responded to that appointment with great alacrity, and there I was, the boy professor. And I knew I drank too much, so I resolved, because I have a finely trained, incredibly honed mind, that I would drink less. So I entered into a period of controlled drinking. I was then 26 years of age when I thought I'd have to control my drinking. I was very unsuccessful at that, but the way things worked out, I was a good teacher. I didn't find that out for a couple of years, but it turned out I was competent to teach, and once I understood that, then there was no reason not to drink the way I wanted to. And I only knew the one way to drink. My father died when I was about 2, and Billy was 4 years older. And Billy was not at all like me. He was a tall, good-looking, handsome Irish Marine. And Billy was my hero. And I did everything, I tried to do everything just like Billy, and I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something happened. I never knew that. I'd see people leaving. I would wonder where they were going. I mean, the whiskey was here. They were going there. And this period of time, too, I did a lot of other things that aren't important, and solely because of my appointment on the faculty, I was appointed to all kinds of commissions and councils by the governor and by the mayor of the city, and I had all kinds of honors and appointments and all that stuff, and I was in politics for a while. I even ran for office one time and lost. I did a lot of things that don't seem to matter. And Miss O'Keefe and I had bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village in Westchester County in New York that abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes, and we had it up to 6 or 7 kids and whatever, and the usual number of motor vehicles and the usual memberships and the usual obscure clubs, and I was teaching and practicing law and politicking and waltzing around, and had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. Matter of fact, I would have told you I was doing very well whether you asked me or not. That's one of my favorite themes. Truth of the matter was, at this time, age 34, I had turned into a daily drunk, and my day would have killed an ordinary man. I used to come 2 in the morning in that wet bed, because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of that damp sack, and I begin my morning aerobics. I was way ahead of my time. My aerobics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I would have all the water running, the water in the shower, and the water in the tub, and the water in the sink, because I did not want Ms. O'Keefe and all of those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would struggle downstairs in my sincere blue suit, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry, because Mrs. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. If you can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I kept a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that daddy's juice. And I take a few bangs on that, and then the question was, would I throw up in front of all these people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I'd get to New York City, to Grand Central. I don't know how much you know about Grand Central. It's really not a railroad terminal. It is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I would tear on the tunnels and pop up like a mole here or there and do a repair job, and then I'd head for the school, and as soon as I got into that imposing institution, my first thought was, how do I get out? And I'd get out, and I'd tear across town to a law firm and steal. And every morning I'd make my raid on the petty cash, and then I'd be down where I really belong, the bar, down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like a mascot or a playmate or something. And I'd throw up my dough, and I'd buy a drink, and they'd buy a drink, and the bartender would buy a drink, and we'd all buy a drink, and it was wonderful. And maybe we'd do some business, and maybe we wouldn't. It didn't make a hell of a lot of difference, because we all had a drink. And I had it figured out in some peculiar alcoholic way that I was particularly brilliant at 2 o'clock. So I'd schedule my classes for 2, and I'd zoom up there and shortchange those poor, unwilling sophisticates who had come to study law at my feet. And then I'd zoom across when that was over, go right over to Grand Central to commute. Even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12. And I'd take a train north. I didn't have to go to Larchmont, where I lived. North was good enough for me. And I got to see a lot of Bridgeport, Connecticut, which I don't recommend to you. Sooner or later, I'd get back home, and I'd bounce a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody would like a martini. But I was the only one who drank in that house at that time. Evenings I would spend in civic endeavor. Lawyers are very fond of civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car, or puking on some hostess's sofa, or playing a little grab ass with the ladies of Larchmont and a sorrier looking crop you have never seen. Most nights, though, I just stay home and vegetate. And I'd watch television with one eye like that, trying to get those sets to come together. And I would go through the programming and on into the news and through the late show and all the rest of it. And finally, my big moment would come when they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And those destroyers would be cutting through the water. And they'd be playing that song, and I would cry. Oh, I would weep and sob and cry. Then I'd go upstairs and wipe the bed. That's it. Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would save for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, which was extremely rare, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, while all of this was going on, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I'd pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she is my wife. How much can she know? Secondly, she is not an attorney. And I would explain to her, because she is a little dense, that alcoholic drinking is a relative thing. And some people drink more than other people. And based on a relative scale, I was not really a big drinker. As a matter of fact, I would say, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much as your mother. Then I'd have to go away for 3 or 4 days because she had offended my mother. I usually won't get drunk with my mother is what I do. So all of this drove her wacko, and she consulted with her physician, who you might imagine was an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk, and this explained things to him, and he sent her home to me with a message. And the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor of law, as an alcoholic. Oh, I was so upset. I rose to defend myself, as was my custom, and began one of my jury addresses. And the first point I made, I thought was a good point. I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice, all too common in our country today. And then I launched into another. I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. At this point, the conversation was going downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you. And I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I'm giving here. But in the middle of all of this thunder, I suddenly stopped and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe for the first time I'd ever admitted to any human, if such she be, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I was overcome with great feelings of outrage and self-pity because, in addition to all of these other terrible things that were going on, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was passing by. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. I think it was Washington and Jefferson that year. And he went away and he left me. And then I did all of those warm, wonderful, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook, I sweat. I did everything else pleasant that you can think about. And I finally came up for air. And I was then visited by the staff of the hospital. And they, of course, were psychiatrists. This was a very fancy rattle box, as befitted a man of my standing. And I gave three different stories to three different psychiatrists. And I was told that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution for not cooperating. And I was cooperating. They were wrong. I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were not alcoholics. They were just there. And we played Monopoly, and we played Monopoly all day long. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very well. And I had the boardwalk, I had a number of hotels, and I thought the therapy was working. I wasn't drinking, and I was happy with Monopoly. And I didn't want anything to do with any doctors or occupational therapy or anything like that. I just played my Monopoly, minding my own business. And they told me about 2 days later I had a visitor. I didn't know what that would be, so I went into my large executive-type padded cell. And I waited for the man to visit, and through that door came this very imposing-looking guy who announced that he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the hospital had given up on me. And they asked him to talk to me about our program. I immediately reverted to my origins, and I almost had him by the throat. Said, "Alcohol, what are you, out of your mind?" And I started with him. He told me to shut up. I immediately forgave him because I knew that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I began to tell him who I was. He told me to sit down and to shut up and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking man, and I was not a well person. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat, and he began to tell me, as we are instructed in the books, Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I have been trying to indicate to you, what his life had been like, how he had come to our program, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "Do you mean outside to meetings, sir?" He said, "Outside." I said, "I'll go." And besides that, he gave me matches. And nobody else had allowed me to have any matches. I thought that showed a certain degree of confidence in me. And so that's how it began. That was in January of 1963. He took me all around, made arrangements for me to come home and go locally. And I arrived back home and started to go locally. And I don't remember so much all of that. I was too new and too nervous and too afraid and too everything. And I knew myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. And you would elect me your president. I would serve a term as your president. We would have a dinner. You would give me a plaque. And that would be that. Well, it should come as no surprise to you, but it was a terrible shock to me to find out I only stayed 10 months, and I was drunk again in October. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference, because I had turned away from the great power that is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time, and I won't take you through it because it takes too long and still makes the hair in the back of my neck go up. But just let me indicate to you that it was without question the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I never knew when I'd be drinking or when I wouldn't be drinking. I never knew where I would be when I was finished drinking. I would drink a week and then I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month and then I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and go to meetings, or I'd go to meetings and then I would drink. Things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I do not speak to you now of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you now of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured full professor of law, and that all of the honors and all of the appointments and all of the committees and all of the dollars that went with that position were taken from me in about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but that's not what I'm talking to you about. But I now understand what's happening in my case, and perhaps in yours. That there was a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me from each of you. That spirit appears to this particular form, whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright, and it was extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing I could do about it. I had been here, and this did not work for me. And by this time, I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the farms and the sanitariums and the drying out places, I've been through the jobs and the politicians and the money, and I've been through the doctors and the nurses, and I've been up and down every avenue there was. And the result was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I drank. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew where the end was. And if I gave these things any thought at all, I don't know what I thought. I suppose I thought, well, if this is the way it is, this is the way it is. And I continued to drink. And I really did not think I would ever stop. Truly, as I stand here with you, I did not think I would ever stop. But my time came one day. One day, my time came. I don't know any more about this than you do, but it does seem to me that there is a line somewhere beyond which we simply are not permitted to go. And it seems to me that there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and a personal thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They called one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and the man told me that my brother had died in the Veterans Hospital, where they had taken him when he collapsed on the street in the skid row of Minneapolis. And so my brother and my hero died the way alcoholics sometimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it can be something fairly trivial. But that line is there, somewhere. And I think that we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it, we must. And I arrived at a day that really wasn't so different from many other days. I was 2 or 3 days away from a drink. I was in this place where I had gotten a job. I was nervous and I was thirsty. And I was thinking about going down. There was a bar in the bottom of the building. But instead of doing that, I had was given the great grace and the opportunity to call a longtime friend of mine who was a longtime member of the ALO program. And his name is John, and he is my sponsor. I told him what was going on, and of course he said he'd be over, and he came over. And he walked into that room, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him how I was to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he gave me that look that he has. And he said, don't drink. Go to meetings. You'll be all right. Well, I really didn't want him to tell me that. So I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. He said, you don't understand the problem, John. The problem really is this place where I'm working. The lawyer of my talent should not be in this place. Well, he said, don't drink. You go to meetings. Get a little better. I said, it's home, it's worse, you know. I can't even go up there anymore, and I got all kinds of people looking for me. Yeah, he said, well, don't drink. You go to meetings, that'll work out. I said, I'm being sued by Bankers Trust. Yeah, he said, I read about that. That's a misunderstanding. Well, he said, don't drink, you go to meetings, be all right. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did he, because he said, come on, you're not doing much. And he made a couple of phone calls and took me over and stuck me on a train to Larchmont. And it's about a 40-minute ride. And halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand? I must have panicked. Call this jerk. Don't drink, right? Don't drink my ass. Wait till this train stops. And that was my attitude when I got off the train. And standing on the platform of the Larchmont station was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was chairman of the local group. And Al said, "Get in the car." And I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." Al said, "Some guy called me from New York about you. Get in the car." Well, a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fist fight with a mailman, or anybody else, for that matter. He'd get killed. So I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I got a lot of trouble here." "Yeah," I said, "well, don't drink, and I'll take you to the meeting. You'll be all right." And Al did. We went to the meeting that night, to my group, and I didn't drink that day. Well, I haven't had a drink since. That was November 24, 1965. First I had that day. And I had that day because two members of this fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of this fellowship that they took what God sent that day, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant hulk of a man. Because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. I hope it is that same sense of gratitude that allows me to be here with you. Because like Al and John and all the rest, I have a great debt to pay. This is one of the ways I do that. I was going to the meetings every day. I still go every day. I go to meetings every day. I never thought I could stay sober any differently than the way I got sober. I go to 9 meetings a week. And I was going to my meetings, and I was seeing John every day, and I saw Al every night, and I was getting my instructions. One day John said to me, "You know, the trouble with you is you're ignorant." He is a real sweetheart, this one. I would say to him, "I don't feel so good." He'd say, "Well, it might be as good as you'll ever feel." I'd say to him, "When am I going to get a good job?" He said, "You had one." He said, "Trouble with you is you're ignorant." He said, "Trouble with you is you think Alcoholics Anonymous is to stop you from drinking." He said, "That's ignorant. The reason you're ignorant," he says, "is you've never read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous." I had him. I said, "I never read the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen anyone fail. You know that look that they give you? That look that longtime members of AA reserve for smart-ass people." I said, "Yes, John." You see, no conversation was ever over with that man until you said, "Yes, John." And when you said that, you heard a click if it was a phone. You say, "Yes, John," and click, it would be over. He'd be gone. So I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. There was some truth to what he had said. I did not understand or appreciate that this book was written some 5 years after the meeting of Bill and Bob, that 100 and so men and women had become sober. And that the way they had become sober, which has already been read to us here tonight, is contained in the 5th chapter of that book. And that the steps that are contained in the 5th chapter of that book are steps literally taken by these men and women as they became sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I told you that my name was Ray O'Keefe and I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step. The men and women who founded this program did a great deal more than identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable, and their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. They were powerless. They had no power. They were without power. It says in this book that the dilemma of the alcoholic is his lack of power. He is powerless. But they didn't drink.
No,
for them. And time has passed for me and for the great convention of Southern California. And if you come here new, my brother, time will pass for you. Time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. This was not just a casual observation that they made or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. This was part of them. They believed, I believe, that there is a power greater than our own. And I believe that this power can do for me all of the things I cannot do for myself. And so firm and so true and so real was that belief in that power that they were able to make a decision. They made a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of this country when no one else had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they made up that admission of powerlessness, their bodies began to heal fairly rapidly. When they came to believe, they enjoyed a mental recovery. And when they made that decision, that was the key that opened the door. They began not only a spiritual recovery, but they set down the basis of a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they knew that there was something else the matter. They knew that it wasn't the drinking. There was something else the matter. And they knew that if they were to stay sober and remain sober, they would have to examine themselves. And so they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They sought to determine the exact nature of their wrongs. And when they were finished with that inventory, so great was the love and the affection of these people one for the other, that they were able to admit that inventory to the God of their understanding, to themselves and to someone else. It was a great relief for me to bring this to my sponsor. It was he who made clear to me the exact nature of my wrongs. And then they developed an attitude which was very difficult for me. Perhaps I made too much of it. They became entirely ready to have God remove all their defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this great power that they had come to believe in. And they humbly asked that power to take their shortcomings from them. And they asked their Creator to take from them both the good and the bad so that they could be useful. A remarkable kind of a prayer. And they knew, too, that they had not come here alone. They knew that in their lives, as in mine, there was a certain amount of wreckage, and so they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed, and they became willing to make amends to the people on that list. And they didn't just talk about it. They went out and they did it. You may recall in our literature, it tells us of Dr. Bob's first day. He had a beer that morning. He went in and did what he had to do, and he got home late that night, and Bill asked him where he'd been. And he said he was driving around Akron, Ohio, in his old Buick, mending fences. It is an old Vermont expression. He was making amends the very first day that he began his program. And I don't think we need wait so long to do all the things that are required of us. Especially so when the benefits are so wonderful and so marvelous. And they are in our book. It says in the book that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door upon it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down we have gone, we will see how our experience will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us all of the things that we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I am happy to report to you that each and every one of those promises has come into my life, wholly, solely, and simply, because I am a member of this fellowship. And by this time, they knew, as I even knew, that what had been given to them was something very, very precious. And so they resolved that they would maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take a personal inventory. They knew they could not afford the luxury of a resentment. They knew that they could not be hateful or resentful. If they were resentful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would surely die. And so when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so real and so true was their reliance upon a power greater than their own, that they resolved to improve their conscious contact with God. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine, a very excellent form of meditation. It is the form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they had come to believe in would speak to them. And this power that they had come to believe in did speak to them in their groups, at their meetings. And they prayed, brothers. They prayed. Nobody needs a sermon from me on the value of prayer. And when they prayed only for knowledge of God's will for them and the power to carry that out. I can't ever tell how it was with you, but it always seemed to me when I was very, very young, from a very, very young age, it always seemed to me that I did not belong. I had this terrible feeling that I was not in the right family. I did not belong with those people. I didn't belong in those schools. I didn't belong there. I didn't want to be there. And that feeling persisted in me. And what was unusual about it, I think it persisted in me even though I was going through the system successfully. I was a successful kid. I had friends. I was all right at school. I knew what I was doing at work. I lived in the right kind of a place, an okay place and an okay house. I did not belong. I was a member of everything. I belonged to nothing. Amazing thing. Then I came here to you, and I learned to pray. In the 12 and 12 on the chapter of prayer, in the last paragraph, and this is not a quotation, but it's close. It says there in the chapter on prayer that perhaps one of the greatest benefits of prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer lost or alone or frightened or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence in the world around us, we see and we understand that the real values of life are truth and justice and love. And that we understand that a loving God watches over us, and that we know when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I am able to report to you that that sense of belonging has come to me. And when I tell you that my name is Ray O'Keefe and I'm an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I am really telling you is who I am and what I am and where I belong. It isn't so much that I'm given the great honor to be here with you. I belong here. I'm supposed to be here. I'm with you. I'm one of you. I fit here. I fit right in. They never should have arrested me in San Diego in 1945. They didn't know I'd be back. A misunderstanding. It was a misunderstanding. And then they came upon another prayer, a prayer that you and I have already prayed. And this time they prayed for themselves. But the only thing they asked was peace of mind. And so they asked God to grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. They changed. Something happened to these men and to these women. There was a great change in their lives. There was a great substitution of their standards. There was a great conversion of their values. And this difference, the difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these are the men and the women who at the beginning of this process were helpless and hopeless and powerless. These are the ones who had no power. But having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts and in our program one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic who suffered. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in October of 1986 in the beautiful city of San Diego in the great state of California. And that, my dear, dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew. They knew what my sponsor knew. They knew what my friend Mary Regan knows, what Vince knows, and what Chris Pine knows. They knew that what had been given to them was much more than a simple device to keep people like me from being drunk. They knew that they had been handed an entirely new way to live. And in order to enjoy that great way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. So where they had been, as I always was, very dishonest, they tried to be honest. Where they had been, as I always was, very arrogant, they tried to be not so arrogant. Happily for me and for us all, they said we are not saints. They said this is not a program of spiritual perfection. It is a program of spiritual progress, and my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and go to the meetings. I could keep you for the rest of the weekend just to tell you all of the marvelous things that have happened to me since I have become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I would not keep you that long. I will not tell you of my golden Cadillac, but let me tell you this. Everything that the disease of alcoholism took from me, every single thing that the disease of alcoholism took from me, every title, every honor, every position, and every dollar has been returned to me in the most marvelous and unexplainable ways that I have long since given up trying to understand. Every single thing. And more importantly, and you will know how I live now when I tell you this, I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of six of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been for the last many years a professor of law. And last May, I was invited by the school which had rehired me to attend their graduation ceremonies as a distinguished guest, to walk with the faculty and personally hand one of my children her law degree. Not bad, huh? Not bad. And all of this is simply something from all of you. I, of course, would be remiss if I did not thank the committee or whoever it was who had the extreme good judgment to bring me in for the period of time that I have been with you. You have made me at home. My friend Vince is a new friend. For the time I've been here, I have been at home, and I belong. I'm one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who gets around. Everywhere I go, I say about the same thing, so if you've heard this before, you're hearing it again. I make no apology for that. And when I end, as I always do, I refer to a pamphlet, which has always been very dear to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the pamphlet was given to Alcoholics Anonymous by Southern California, called The Members' View. And in that pamphlet, at the end of it, the author took a biblical turn. And he recalls the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And one day they stopped him and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for, or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question, but he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. Tell John that the deaf hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear brothers, in marvelous convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk, and most certainly the deaf can hear. And I know that the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.